We are awaiting a landmark moment. President Obama will deliver a speech in Havana, Cuba, at a century-old theater. We will be able to listen to it here, and the Cuban people, we are told, will be able to listen or watch there. This is just one of two major stories we're following this morning. The other is today's attack in Brussels, Belgium. A major airport and a metro station were struck. Explosions in both those locations. More than 24 people were killed. We do expect President Obama to address that attack when he starts to talk in a few minutes. And for now, we're going to bring everybody up to date on that story. NPR counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston has been following this and other attacks. She's in New York. Good morning, Dina.
Good morning.
So what is the latest you've learned here about what has happened and in what order? This began at the airport, correct?
It began at the airport around 8 o'clock this morning. There was either one or two giant explosions in the departure hall, which is before you get through security in the airport. Then about a half hour later, there was a blast on the metro in central Belgium near the EU headquarters around 9:30. And my sources tell me that that blast actually took place inside a car near the Malbeek or Malbec station in Brussels.
Inside a train car, so an especially deadly location. And when you say that particular station, we learned that it's of quite some significance because of its location.
It's very close. It's not necessarily the station that you get off on to go to the EU, but it's, you know, very close, within like 400 yards of the entrance to the EU.
You must have been in contact with U.S. counterterrorism officials today. How closely are they watching events in Europe?
They're watching this very closely, and they've been watching basically what's been going on for the past week. Last Tuesday, there was a big raid on a safe house in just outside of the center of Brussels, and they found someone who they had identified as a former ISIS fighter who was there with a Kalashnikov who shot at police. They were surprised by that. And then they found this fingerprint that was a very important fingerprint of Saleh Abdeslam. It was on a water glass, so they knew it was fresh. And this is the man who's known basically as the only survivor of the Paris attacks. And then on Friday, they actually found him and arrested him.
So on Tuesday, they find the fingerprint. By Friday, they track him down and arrest him. And ever since that arrest, authorities had been awaiting an attack in Brussels.
Well, among other things that they've found as they were scouring to try and find Abdeslam were caches of weapons around Brussels, including some detonators, but not some suicide vests. So they naturally thought that there was something that was going to happen, or at least there was some sort of network that they weren't aware of that they were trying to chase.
So if you put yourself in the shoes of an investigator, which your job requires you to try to do with your imagination, what questions would you be asking next?
Where's the bomb maker? That's the really key thing here. These vests have been made with something called TATP, which you can make with sort of bleach and peroxide. But it's incredibly volatile, so not just anyone can make it. You need an expert. They're looking for the bomb maker.
Okay, Dina, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's counterterrorism correspondent, Dina Temple-Raston. She will stay with us throughout this morning as we continue to cover the events in Brussels, Belgium. We do expect President Obama to, in some way, speak to those events when he delivers his speech in Havana today. And let's listen to one of the sounds that has been heard in Cuba in this past day. Star-Spangled Banner in Havana, Cuba, a military band playing as President Obama arrived yesterday at the Palace of the Cuban Revolution and spoke with Cuba's communist leader, Raul Castro. Now, President Obama is preparing to give a speech, which will be heard by the Cuban people, we are told. NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley has been traveling with the president. He's in Havana. Hi, Scott.
Good to be with you, Steve.
Would you set the scene for us? Where is this speech taking place?
The president will be speaking at the Gran Teatro, which is a beautiful old theater overlooking the Central Park here in Havana. It was built at the turn of the last century, and it looks like a European-style opera house with balconies climbing steeply up the sides. There are about 1,100 seats in the theater, but of course the president's audience will be much larger than that because this speech will be televised. So folks all over the island can see what the president has to say, can hear his words. And he'll also, of course, be addressing the Cuban-American community in the United States, who have a deep investment in this and who are more deeply divided about this outreach to Cuba than the U.S. population at large.
So as with many speeches, the most vital audiences are surely the people watching on television. But what about those 1,100 seats in the theater? Who's there, so far as you know?
These are invited guests, and they'll be listing. There's going to be no introduction for the president, so this is a sort of a sterile event. He'll be introduced by what they call the voice of God, a recorded announcement. They didn't want to, you know, share the stage with, say, a Cuban official or anyone like that. This is an opportunity for the president to really spell out his vision for what a new day, as he described it, between the U.S. and Cuba will be after half a century of official isolation. You know, he remarked himself yesterday on what a thing it is to hear the Star-Spangled Banner played by a Cuban military band, what a thing it is to see the President of the United States in Havana, a sight that would have been unimaginable, he said, for decades. But here he is, and he's going to talk about what he sees going forward.
I can imagine why, but why would the president not want to share the stage with a Cuban official before his speech?
This is an opportunity for him to address the Cuban people directly, unmediated by officials, by dissidents, and he's meeting with both officials and dissidents while he's here. But this is a chance for him to really speak one-on-one to the Cuban public. It was an amazing thing yesterday when he did share the stage with Cuban President Raul Castro, a dramatic moment. We were all sort of wondering, would the Cuban president take questions from the American press corps as President Obama did, and Raul Castro did take questions. I won't say necessarily answered the questions, but he did at least have to sort of stand there and face scrutiny from American reporters about Cuba's human rights record, about political prisoners in this country. And he raised some questions of his own about conditions in the United States, about health care and education in the U.S. The president said, and his aides have said, look, the United States is not afraid to face our questioners, and the Cuban government shouldn't duck those kinds of tough queries either.
So much to dig into there, and we're going to dig into a little bit of it as we wait for the president to speak. NPR's Tom Gelton is in our studios here in Washington, one of many correspondents standing by and whom we expect to hear from in this hour. Tom wrote a book about Cuba, has thought about Cuba, traveled to Cuba for quite some time. Tom, how big a deal is it that the president of the United States is standing there, about to stand there in that theater?
It's a huge deal, Steve. You've heard many times the last U.S. president to visit Cuba was Calvin Coolidge back in 1928. Mm-hmm. So 80-some years have passed since then. There is one interesting point to make. While Barack Obama is the first sitting U.S. president to visit Cuba, Jimmy Carter visited Cuba in 2002, and there are a lot of parallels with that visit. He, too, drove a very hard bargain with the Cuban authorities over what conditions would be imposed on his visit. He insisted on speaking live to the Cuban people, just as President Obama is doing. The Cuban authorities originally said, you can do that on television. He said, I want it to go out on radio as well, because a lot more Cubans were listening to the radio in those days than watching television. And during that speech, which was, in the end, broadcast on both television and radio to the Cuban people, Jimmy Carter mentioned Oswaldo Paya, who was a dissident leading a referendum drive at the time to get a referendum for the Cuban people to vote on whether they should have political reform in Cuba or not. And Jimmy Carter quite boldly mentioned that referendum drive. It had a huge impact in Cuba. People didn't even know about this referendum drive. So that's an interesting parallel. He used that occasion to really promote change in Cuba.
Probably the most publicity that guy ever received. Now, our diplomatic correspondent, Michelle Kellerman, covers the State Department, of course, and has been following all the diplomatic maneuvering that led up to this. How hard was it to arrange the details?
Well, it's interesting. You know, John Kerry actually wanted to go a few weeks ago to raise the issue of human rights, and in the end didn't go. And in part, it was because the embassy was just stretched thin. This is a new embassy. It was called an intersection before. And when they decided to reestablish diplomatic relations, they turned it into a full embassy. But they don't really have the staff that they need. They can't really get out as freely as they can in other countries, the Cubans put very tough restrictions on people. They have to let them know 72 hours ahead of time before they take any trips. So it was difficult to arrange Obama's trip, but, you know, they couldn't even get John Kerry's trip off the ground.
Sorry, Secretary Kerry, you're only the Secretary of State. We really don't have time for you. So we are looking now at televised images of the Gran Teatro in Havana, a couple of flags side by side, the Cuban flag, the U.S. flag. There's a lectern there at which President Obama will stand after being introduced by that voice of God, as we heard Scott Horsley describe it. As we await that speech coming in a few minutes, I want to go back to the streets of Havana. NPR's Kerry Khan is in Cuba, has covered this country off and on for years. Kerry, where are you?
I am in the home of just a resident here in Old Havana, beautiful Old Havana. And I convinced them to let me into their home, and all their neighbors have come in to watch the speech.
Oh, I hope they're serving food or something like that for you as well. Coffee?
No,
anything?
They offered me coffee, but it would be my custom to bring them some food, and I didn't. So I'll have to do that after we're done.
Okay, so who are you going to be watching the speech with then? Who are these people?
They were just residents that were kind enough to let me into their home. I'm here with Ronaldo Oliva. He has kind of a dual employment. He works for the state, but he also is taking advantage of the small opening in the private sector here, and he's a driver, and that is on his own dime, and he makes his own money, and they call them cuenta propistas, they're self-employed. He's here with his wife and his mother-in-law and some neighbors.
Which, of course, is really common in Cuba. You have the informal as well as the formal economy, and people might make more money in the informal economy.
No, it is a formal. It's formal. It is licensed by the state. That is what is so amazing about it. In communist Cuba, about 25% of the workforce now is self-employed, allowed by the state to get licenses for certain categories of employment, and this is money that they get to keep. They make far more in the self-employed sector, the private sector, than they could as a state salary.
Thanks for correcting me. Now, in the last couple of days, as President Obama and his family have moved around Havana, how much excitement have you noticed, if any, among the Cuban populace?
When you talk to Cubans, they're very excited, and expectations are incredibly high that this visit will bring about change. And when we talk about change, for most people in Cuba, that change is economic change. We're not talking about political change. If the political economic system changes, of course, but everybody is mostly concerned with the economics here. It's a very poor country where the average Cuban salary is about $15 to $20 a month, which is very difficult for people to eke out a living. So that's the kind of change the wide majority of people are hoping that President Obama can help in some way. So as I said, expectations are very high.
I think that's a good occasion to bring in NPR's Jim Zaroli, who covers business. He's with us in our New York bureau. Jim, what are the business possibilities here?
Well, I think that there's certainly a lot of businesses are going to Cuba. A lot of trade delegations have been there, really in the hundreds at this point. A lot of businesses see a great deal of possibility there. They're looking into it. There have been some initial deals. Some companies are already there, like Sprint. There's a tractor company from Alabama called Kleber that is already arranging to start a factory there. Marriott, General Electric, Carnival Cruise. Lots of people see this as a huge business opportunity, and they're eager to go in there.
You know, let me ask about that, because, of course, we've covered the economic opening or the attempted economic opening of Iran, and there's still so much uncertainty there that there's been a limitation of business interest from the outside. People would like to sell stuff in Iran, but there's still a considerable reluctance to invest money in Iran because investors don't really know if they're going to be able to get the money out again. What's the situation with Cuba? Are people willing to dive in, as you describe, and build factories and put money in a serious way?
Well, you know, President Raul Castro has really taken some steps to open up the economy, as Kerry pointed out. You know, 500,000 Cubans are now small business owners or work for small business owners. But this is still really a controlled, almost a Soviet-style economy. Foreigners are still barred from owning property in Cuba. And if you do business in Cuba, you're really still going to often do business with state-owned enterprises. Government wants a majority stake in businesses that get started there. Most of Cuba's trade apparatus is still controlled by the state. So that's a different situation than American businesses are. A lot of them are used to. And Cuba has made clear it's not going to change the way it does business just to please the United States.
Tom Jelton.
As Jim said, there have been hundreds of trade delegations going to Cuba and a lot of interest on the part of U.S. businesses to do business in Cuba. But it's really been disproportionate. I mean, very few deals have been negotiated. Jim mentioned a couple, but there's tremendous ambivalence on the part of Cuban authorities to ink these deals and really some uncertainty about whether they really want to go down this road all that fast, all that far.
Scott Horsley in Havana, we're watching televised images. Is that President Raul Castro who's just walked into the theater there?
That's right. Raul Castro was just introduced to the crowd. He's sitting in one of those balconies in the theater here. So he'll get to hear firsthand what the president says to the Cuban people. Of course, they had a chance to talk one-on-one yesterday. You know, you're talking about these formal investments by U.S. businesses, Steve. One aspect of the opening that maybe hasn't been heralded quite as much in the United States is the lifting of limits on money transfers to Cuba. Even before the formal opening that was announced in December of 2014, President Obama had lifted the cap on how much money Cuban Americans and others can send to relatives in Cuba, and now that cap has been removed altogether. Money flowing from the United States is what has bankrolled so many of those Cuban entrepreneurs, those restaurant owners and drivers and other small business people. And when I talk to the politicians who are accompanying the president here on this trip, they say the growth of that private sector, bankrolled in large part by Cuban-American money transfers, is a huge wedge, a huge lever to opening up not only the economy of Cuba, but the political system here. Because those Cuentropopistas, you know, once they're not as dependent on the state for their income, they're a lot freer to challenge the state politically.
Looked to me like somebody was adjusting perhaps the presidential seal there just moments before President Obama arrives. If we have a few seconds, let's bring in one more voice very briefly. Professor Christopher Sabatini, he's a Latin America specialist at Columbia University. Good morning to you. What are you expecting to hear? What do you want to hear in this speech?
Well, those are two separate things, I guess. I would like to hear a little bit more of a focus on human rights than he gave yesterday in his press conference with Raul Castro, in which he sort of looked like he was walking on eggshells a little, kind of apologetic and sort of accepting some of Castro's pushback. I think what I am expecting to hear, though, is I think you're going to see and hear a real call from Obama about sort of the similarities that the Cuban and people and the American people share, about their shared history, their shared culture, their familial ties, and trying to inspire some hope in an island that has existed for over 50 years under a repressive, closed economic system and political system that is increasingly frustrated, in which really the steam economically is running out of the Cuban system. I think what he's going to try to do is to speak directly to the Cuban people and appeal to them, you know, without all the dialogue, without all the sort of politics and geopolitics that surrounded our relationship.
Is this an occasion where he can tweak, if that's the word, tweak his hosts on human rights and political freedoms the way that Jimmy Carter did years ago?
Well, Tom mentioned very well. I mean, I think what Jimmy Carter did was very artful. Basically, what he did was he mentioned a particular dissident who was engaging in a very active and important project.
And let me just interrupt you there, because President Obama is now stepping to the lectern at the Gran Teatro.
The United States of America, Barack Obama.
President acknowledging the waves, acknowledging the applause, waving to the crowd.
Muchas gracias. Thank you so much. Please. Thank you very much. To President Castro, the people of Cuba, thank you so much for the warm welcome that I have received, that my family have received, and that our delegation has received. It is an extraordinary honor to be here today. Before I begin, please indulge me. I want to comment on the terrorist attacks that have taken place in Brussels. The thoughts and the prayers of the American people are with the people of Belgium, and we stand in solidarity with them in condemning these outrageous attacks against innocent people. We will do whatever is necessary to support our friend and ally Belgium in bringing to justice those who are responsible. And this is yet another reminder that the world must unite We must be together, regardless of nationality or race or faith, in fighting against the scourge of terrorism. We can and we will defeat those who threaten the safety and security of people all around the world. To the government and the people of Cuba, I want to thank you for the kindness that you've shown to me and Michelle, Malia, Sasha, my mother-in-law, Marion. Cultivo una rosa blanca. In his famous poem, José Martí made this offering of friendship and peace to both his friend and his enemy. Today, as the President of the United States of America, I offer the Cuban people el saludo de paz. Havana is only 90 miles from Florida, but to get here, we had to travel a great distance over barriers of history and ideology, barriers of pain and separation. The blue waters beneath Air Force One once carried American battleships to this island to liberate, but also to exert control over Cuba. Those waters also carried generations of Cuban revolutionaries to the United States, where they built support for their cause. And that short distance has been crossed by hundreds of thousands of Cuban exiles on planes and makeshift rafts, who came to America in pursuit of freedom and opportunity, sometimes leaving behind everything they owned and every person that they loved. Like so many people in both of our countries, my lifetime has spanned a time of isolation between us. The Cuban Revolution took place the same year that my father came to the United States from Kenya. The Bay of Pigs took place the year that I was born. The next year, the entire world held its breath, watching our two countries as humanity came as close as we ever have to the horror of nuclear war. As the decades rolled by, our government settled into a seemingly endless confrontation, fighting battles through proxies. In a world that remade itself time and again, one constant was the conflict between the United States and Cuba. I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas.
The president speaking in Havana today. You're listening to live special coverage.
I have come here to extend the hand of friendship to the Cuban people. I want to be clear. The differences between our governments over these many years are real, and they are important. I'm sure President Castro would say the same thing. I know because I've heard him address those differences at length. But before I discuss those issues, we also need to recognize how much we share. Because in many ways, the United States and Cuba are like two brothers who've been estranged for many years, even as we share the same blood. We both live in a new world, colonized by Europeans. Cuba, like the United States, was built in part by slaves brought here from Africa. Like the United States, the Cuban people can trace their heritage to both slaves and slave owners. We've welcomed both immigrants who came a great distance to start new lives in the Americas. Over the years, our cultures have blended together. Dr. Carlos Finlay's work in Cuba paved the way for generations of doctors, including Walter Reed, who drew on Dr. Finlay's work to help combat yellow fever. Just as Martí wrote some of his most famous words in New York, Ernest Hemingway made a home in Cuba and found inspiration in the waters of these shores. We share a national pastime, la pelota. And later today, our players will compete on the same Havana field that Jackie Robinson played on before he made his major league debut. And it's said that our greatest boxer, Muhammad Ali, once paid tribute to a Cuban that he could never fight, saying that he would only be able to reach a draw with the great Cuban, Teófilo Stevenson. So even as our governments became adversaries, our people continued to share these common passions, particularly as so many Cubans came to America. In Miami or Havana, you can find places to dance the cha-cha-cha or the salsa and eat ropa vieja. People in both of our countries have sung along with Celia Cruz or Gloria Estefan and now listen to reggaeton or Pitbull. Millions of our people share a common religion, a faith that I paid tribute to at the Shrine of Our Lady of Charity in Miami, a peace that Cubans find in La Cachita. For all of our differences, the Cuban and American people share common values in their own lives, a sense of patriotism and a sense of pride, a lot of pride, a profound love of family, a passion for our children, a commitment to their education. And that's why I believe our grandchildren will look back on this period of isolation as an aberration, as just one chapter in a longer story of family and of friendship. But we cannot and should not ignore the very real differences that we have about how we organize our governments, our economies, and our societies. Cuba has a one-party system. The United States is a multi-party democracy. Cuba has a socialist economic model. The United States is an open market. Cuba has emphasized the role and rights of the state. The United States is founded upon the rights of the individual. Despite these differences, on December 17, 2014, President Castro and I announced that the United States and Cuba would begin a process to normalize relations between our countries. Since then, we've established diplomatic relations and opened embassies. We've begun initiatives to cooperate on health and agriculture, education, and law enforcement. We've reached agreements to restore direct flights and mail service. We've expanded commercial ties and increased the capacity of Americans to travel and do business in Cuba. And these changes have been welcomed, even though there are still opponents to these policies. Still, many people on both sides of this debate have asked, why now? Why now? There is one simple answer. What the United States was doing was not working. We have to have the courage to acknowledge that truth. A policy of isolation designed for the Cold War made little sense in the 21st century. The embargo was only hurting the Cuban people instead of helping them. And I've always believed in what Martin Luther King Jr. called the fierce urgency of now. We should not fear change. We should embrace it.
The president, having gestured to the Cuban people, gesturing toward his critics there at home and defending his policy here in the United States.
That leads me to a bigger and more important reason for these changes. Creo en el pueblo cubano. I believe in the Cuban people. This is not just a policy of normalizing relations with the Cuban government. The United States of America is normalizing relations with the Cuban people. And today I want to share with you my vision of what our future can be. I want the Cuban people, especially the young people, to understand why I believe that you should look to the future with hope. Not the false promise which insists that things are better than they really are, or the blind optimism that says all your problems can go away tomorrow. Hope that is rooted in the future that you can choose, and that you can shape, and that you can build for your country. I'm hopeful because I believe that the Cuban people are as innovative as any people in the world. In a global economy powered by ideas and information, a country's greatest asset is its people. In the United States, we have a clear monument to what the Cuban people can build. It's called Miami. Here in Havana, we see that same talent in Cuento Propistas, cooperatives, and old cars that still run. El Cubano inventa del aire.
The Cuban invents out of the air, he says.
Cuba has an extraordinary resource, a system of education which values every boy and every girl. And in recent years, the Cuban government has begun to open up to the world and to open up more space for that talent to thrive. In just a few years, we've seen how Cuento Propistas can succeed while sustaining a distinctly Cuban spirit. Being self-employed is not about becoming more like America, it's about being yourself. Look at Sandra Lidice Aldama, who chose to start a small business. Cuban, she said, can innovate and adapt without losing our identity. Our secret is not in copying or imitating, but simply being ourselves. Look at Papito Valladares, a barber whose success allowed him to improve conditions in his neighborhood. I realize I'm not going to solve all the world's problems, he said, but if I can solve problems in the little piece of the world where I live, it can ripple across Havana. That's where hope begins. With the ability to earn your own living and to build something you can be proud of. That's why our policies focus on supporting Cubans instead of hurting them. That's why we got rid of limits on remittances so ordinary Cubans have more resources. That's why we're encouraging travel, which will build bridges between our people and bring more revenue to those Cuban small businesses. That's why we've opened up space for commerce and exchanges so that Americans and Cubans can work together to find cures for diseases and create jobs and open the door to more opportunity for the Cuban people. As President of the United States, I've called on our Congress to lift the embargo.
President Obama in Havana, this is special coverage from NPR News.
It is an outdated burden on the Cuban people. It's a burden on the Americans who want to work and do business or invest here in Cuba. It's time to lift the embargo. But even if we lifted the embargo tomorrow, Cubans would not realize their potential without continued change here in Cuba. It should be easier to open a business here in Cuba. A worker should be able to get a job directly with companies who invest here in Cuba. Two currencies shouldn't separate the type of salaries that Cubans can earn. The internet should be available across the island so that Cubans can connect to the wider world and to one of the greatest engines of growth in human history. There's no limitation from the United States on the ability of Cuba to take these steps. It's up to you. And I can tell you as a friend that sustainable prosperity in the 21st century depends on education, healthcare, and environmental protection, but it also depends on the free and open exchange of ideas. If you can't access information online, if you cannot be exposed to different points of view, you will not reach your full potential. And over time, the youth will lose hope. I know these issues are sensitive, especially coming from an American president. Before 1959, some Americans saw Cuba as something to exploit, ignored poverty, enabled corruption. And since 1959, we've been shadow boxers in this battle of geopolitics and personalities. I know the history, but I refuse to be trapped by it.
A little bit of applause there. No applause at all when he spoke of a free and open exchange of ideas.
I've made it clear that the United States has neither the capacity nor the intention to impose change on Cuba. What changes come will depend upon the Cuban people. We will not impose our political or economic system on you. We recognize that every country, every people, must chart its own course and shape its own model. But having removed the shadow of history from our relationship, I must speak honestly about the things that I believe, the things that we as Americans believe. As Martí said, liberty is the right of every man to be honest, to think and to speak without hypocrisy. So let me tell you what I believe. I can't force you to agree, but you should know what I think. I believe that every person should be equal under the law. Every child deserves the dignity that comes with education and health care and food on the table and a roof over their heads. I believe citizens should be free to speak their mind without fear, to organize and to criticize their government and to protest peacefully, and that the rule of law should not include arbitrary detentions of people who exercise those rights. I believe that every person should have the freedom to practice their faith peacefully and publicly. And yes, I believe voters should be able to choose their governments in free and democratic elections. Not everybody agrees with me on this. Not everybody agrees with the American people on this, but I believe those human rights are universal. I believe they are the rights of the American people, the Cuban people, and people around the world. Now, there's no secret that our governments disagree on many of these issues. I've had frank conversations with President Castro. For many years, he has pointed out the flaws in the American system: economic inequality, the death penalty, racial discrimination, wars abroad. That's just a sample. He has a much longer list. But here's what the Cuban people need to understand. I welcome this open debate and dialogue. It's good. It's healthy. I'm not afraid of it. We do have too much money in American politics. But in America, it's still possible for somebody like me, a child who was raised by a single mom, a child of mixed race who did not have a lot of money, to pursue and achieve the highest office in the land. That's what's possible in America. We do have challenges with racial bias in our communities, in our criminal justice system, in our society, the legacy of slavery and segregation. But the fact that we have open debates within America's own democracy is what allows us to get better. In 1959, the year that my father moved to America, it was illegal for him to marry my mother, who was white, in many American states. When I first started school, we were still struggling to desegregate schools across the American South. But people organized. They protested. They debated these issues. They challenged government officials. And because of those protests and because of those debates and because of popular mobilization, I'm able to stand here today as an African American and as President of the United States. That was because of the freedoms that were afforded in the United States, that we were able to bring about change. I'm not saying this is easy. There's still enormous problems in our society. But democracy is the way that we solve them. That's how we got health care for more of our people. That's how we made enormous gains in women's rights and gay rights. It's how we address the inequality that concentrates so much wealth at the top of our society, because workers can organize and ordinary people have a voice. American democracy has given our people the opportunity to pursue their dreams and enjoy a high standard of living.
The president before a Cuban flag and American flag in Havana.
There are still some tough fights. It isn't always pretty, the process of democracy. It's often frustrating. You can see that in the election going on back home. But just stop and consider this fact about the American campaign that's taking place right now. You had two Cuban Americans in the Republican Party running against the legacy of a black man who was president, while arguing that they're the best person to beat the Democratic nominee, who will either be a woman or a Democratic socialist. Who would have believed that back in 1959? That's a measure of our progress as a democracy. So, here's my message to the Cuban government and the Cuban people. The ideals that are the starting point for every revolution, America's revolution, Cuba's revolution, the liberation movements around the world, those ideals find their truest expression, I believe, in democracy. Not because American democracy is perfect, but precisely because we're not. And we, like every country, need the space that democracy gives us to change. It gives individuals the capacity to be catalysts, to think in new ways, and to reimagine how our society should be, and to make them better. And there's already an evolution taking place inside of Cuba, a generational change. Many suggested that I come here and ask the people of Cuba to tear something down, but I'm appealing to the young people of Cuba who will lift something up, build something new. El futuro de Cuba tiene que estar en las manos del pueblo cubano.
Cuba's future has to be in the hands of the Cuban people.
And to President Castro, who I appreciate being here today, I want you to know, I believe my visit here demonstrates you do not need to fear a threat from the United States. And given your commitment to Cuba's sovereignty and self-determination, I am also confident that you need not fear the different voices of the Cuban people and their capacity to speak and assemble and vote for their leaders. In fact, I am hopeful for the future because I trust that the Cuban people will make the right decisions. And as you do, I'm also confident that Cuba can continue to play an important role in the hemisphere and around the globe. And my hope is that you can do so as a partner with the United States. We've played very different roles in the world, but no one should deny the service that thousands of Cuban doctors have delivered for the poor and suffering. Last year, American healthcare workers and the U.S. military worked side by side with Cubans to save lives and stamp out Ebola in West Africa. I believe that we should continue that kind of cooperation in other countries. We've been on the different side of so many conflicts in the Americas, but today, Americans and Cubans are sitting together at the negotiating table, and we are helping the Colombian people resolve a civil war that's dragged on for decades. That kind of cooperation is good for everybody. It gives everyone in this hemisphere hope. We took different journeys to our support for the people of South Africa in ending apartheid. But President Castro and I could both be there in Johannesburg to pay tribute to the legacy of the great Nelson Mandela. And in examining his life and his words, I'm sure we both realize we have more work to do to promote equality in our own countries, to reduce discrimination based on race in our own countries. And in Cuba, we want our engagement to help lift up the Cubans who are of African descent, who've proven that there's nothing they cannot achieve when given the chance. We've been a part of different blocks of nations in the hemisphere, and we will continue to have profound differences about how to promote peace, security, opportunity, and human rights. But as we normalize our relations, I believe it can help foster a greater sense of unity in the Americas. Todos somos americanos. From the beginning of my time in office, I've urged the people of the Americas to leave behind the ideological battles of the past. We are in a new era. I know that many of the issues that I've talked about lack the drama of the past. And I know that part of Cuba's identity is its pride in being a small island nation that could stand up for its rights and shake the world. But I also know that Cuba will always stand out because of the talent, hard work, and pride of the Cuban people. That's your strength. Cuba doesn't have to be defined by being against the United States any more than the United States should be defined by being against Cuba. And I'm hopeful for the future because of the reconciliation that's taking place among the Cuban people. You know, I know that for some Cubans on the island, there may be a sense that those who left somehow supported the old order in Cuba. I'm sure there's a narrative that lingers here which suggests that Cuban exiles ignored the problems of pre-revolutionary Cuba and rejected the struggle to build a new future. But I can tell you today that so many Cuban exiles carry a memory of painful and sometimes violent separation. They love Cuba. A part of them still considers this their true home. That's why their passion is so strong. That's why their heartache is so great. And for the Cuban-American community that I've come to know and respect, this is not just about politics. This is about family, the memory of a home that was lost, the desire to rebuild a broken bond, the hope for a better future, the hope for return and reconciliation. For all of the politics, people are people and Cubans are Cubans. And I've come here, I've traveled this distance on a bridge that was built by Cubans on both sides of the Florida Straits. I first got to know the talent and passion of the Cuban people in America. And I know how they have suffered more than the pain of exile. They also know what it's like to be an outsider and to struggle and to work harder to make sure their children can reach higher in America. So the reconciliation of the Cuban people, the children and grandchildren of revolution, and the children and grandchildren of exile, That is fundamental to Cuba's future. You see it in Gloria Gonzalez, who traveled here in 2013 for the first time after 61 years of separation, and was met by her sister, Yorka. You recognize me, but I didn't recognize you, Gloria said after she embraced her sibling. Imagine that after 61 years. You see it in Melinda Lopez, who came to her family's old home. And as she was walking the streets, an elderly woman recognized her as her mother's daughter and began to cry. She took her into her home and showed her a pile of photos that included Melinda's baby picture, which her mother had sent 50 years ago. Melinda later said, "So many of us are now getting so much back." You see it in Christian Miguel Soler, a young man who became the first of his family to travel here after 50 years. And meeting relatives for the first time, he said, "I realized that family is family no matter the distance between us." Sometimes the most important changes start in small places. The tides of history can leave people in conflict and exile and poverty. It takes time for those circumstances to change, but the recognition of a common humanity, the reconciliation of people bound by blood and a belief in one another, that's where progress begins. Understanding and listening and forgiveness. And if the Cuban people face the future together, it will be more likely that the young people of today will be able to live with dignity and achieve their dreams right here in Cuba. The history of the United States and Cuba encompass revolution and conflict, struggle and sacrifice, retribution, and now reconciliation. It is time now for us to leave the past behind. It is time for us to look forward to the future together. Un futuro de esperanza. And it won't be easy, and there will be setbacks. It will take time. But my time here in Cuba renews my hope and my confidence in what the Cuban people will do. We can make this journey as friends and as neighbors and as family together. Sí se puede. Muchas gracias. Thank you.
Yes, we can, the President of the United States says. Thank you very much. President Obama, speaking at the Gran Teatro in Havana as Raul Castro and 1,100 invited guests look on, you're listening to special coverage of the president's visit to Cuba from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. And as the music goes on in Havana, let's continue the discussion here. We're going to hear from a number of our correspondents and analysts. Let's begin with Professor Christopher Sabatini, Latin American specialist at Columbia University. Professor, we heard you before the speech say that up to now, the president has seemed like he is walking on eggshells when it comes to human rights in Cuba. How did he sound today?
I think he sounded very strong. He clearly is being the diplomat, and he's clearly speaking to a number of audiences. One of them is to the Cuban people, and he's trying to share both his own sort of experiences and also sort of appeal to them on the benefits of human rights. We talked about the power. He talked about the power of human rights and freedom for economic growth. I think what was also interesting, though, is he talked to Cuban Americans about the need for reconciliation. I think that's very important because I think many people have feared, and Tom has written about this as well in his book, excellent book, by the way, that this division is very, very powerful, and a lot of people within Cuba even fear the return of the exiles will exact some sort of form of retribution against them after 50 years. And so I think it's a very powerful speech. He spoke very elliptically about human rights, but mm-hmm. I understand that. It was powerful in the way he did it. But it was very elliptical.
And Tom Gelton here in our studios thanks you for the book plug there, by the way. Let's go to one of the audiences the president was trying to address, the Cuban people. Our correspondent Carrie Kahn is with some of them. She found her way into a Cuban home and watched the speech there. Carrie, what was the response as the president spoke?
I think people were a little stunned, a little shocked. They were also shocked to have a U.S. reporter in their bedroom, but they were kind of muted watching the speech, but you'd see a lot of heads shaking, yes, 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 especially when President Obama spoke about the economic changes that he was hoping for, that people could do their own business, could keep their own money. That got the most response here from people. They were very happy about that. And the man who lives here, who this is his home and was very kind to let me in here, he said, this is the first American president who has ever spoken the truth. He kept saying that over and over again.
Well,
he was very impressed by that.
Let me ask about that, Carrie. Of course, there were 1,100 invited guests inside the Gran Teatro. They applauded a lot. There was very little applause, though, and sometimes no applause at all when the president spoke about a free and open exchange of ideas, saying that citizens should be free to speak their mind without fear, that they should be able to vote for their own leaders. What was the reaction in the home where you were when the president said those things?
I think that's when people got more animated. There was a lot of heads just shaking yes, shaking yes. It was quite interesting. And then they were looking at each other sideways, giving each other glances. I don't know if they were muted in their response because I'm here or they were just shocked by it. It just seemed people were stunned by that, but they were smiling, they were shaking their head yes, and looking at each other side to side. I think the speech has been very, very well received. It's just the image of seeing this American president talking to, this was an invitation-only crowd. They definitely, who was in theater, that theater was not open to the Cuban people because they didn't want any sort of response. So very interesting just to see their response and to see the response here. And I think it was just amazing to see an American president speaking to the Cuban people and talking about liberty and freedom and democracy and the obligation to let your people vote, keep their own money. It's just the historic feeling of that and being here in Cuba is overwhelming, I think, for everybody.
Well, let's go to the guy with that book. Tom Gelton, what stood out for you in this speech?
Well, I thought it was interesting that he really formalized a huge change in U.S. policy toward Cuba. I mean, U.S. policy toward Cuba for 50 years has encompassed travel and trade restrictions. Mm-hmm. President Obama officially said that was a policy designed for the Cold War. What that does is it detaches that policy from the promotion of human rights and democracy. He talked a lot about human rights and democracy, but it's really clear that from here on, he thinks the United States should be promoting human rights and democracy in Cuba sort of through a moral appeal, really taking that out of the U.S. policy bag toward Cuba, which, again, he says that was a Cold War policy. Well, in 1996, actually, U.S. Congress made the promotion of human rights and democracy part of the justification for travel and trade restrictions under the Helms-Burton law. President Obama has really rejected that premise completely.
He says he's rejecting history. And just to note very quickly, he did talk about human rights and so forth. He didn't name names. He didn't call for anybody in particular to be freed or anything else.
No, that's right. And he is going to be meeting with some dissidents, later today. There were dissidents who were rounded up. President Obama did not mention that and did not call on them to be freed.
Okay, thanks very much. That's NPR's Tom Gelton. NPR's Carrie Kahn is with us in Havana. NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley also helped us out, along with our correspondent Michelle Kellerman and Jim Zaroli in New York. Thanks also to Professor Christopher Sabatini. In the few seconds we have, let's review some of the things the president said in this historic speech. With Raul Castro in the audience, he said, "I have come here to bury the last remnants of the Cold War in the Americas." He talked about baseball, la pelota, shared interests of the Cuban and American peoples. He said what the U.S. was doing was not working, that the embargo against Cuba was outdated. He said that he refused to be trapped by that history. And although there was not much applause inside the Gran Teatro itself, as he said these next things, he talked of freeing up the internet, of a free and open exchange of ideas, saying that citizens should be free to speak their minds without fear, that they should be able to vote for their own leaders. He even managed to praise the United States' own elections, in spite of the great angst those elections have caused some people here in the United States.